Welcome to Pharmaceutical Executives Leadership Series with corporate strategy expert Ken Banta. Ken is CEO of the Vanguard Network, the membership and consulting organization for C-suite executives. I'm Mike Christel, Group Managing Editor at MJH Life Sciences. In this episode, we're joined by Craig Tooman, veteran biopharma executive and former CEO of Silence Therapeutics, whose leadership career has spanned finance, strategy, drug development, and company building. This conversation explores why the most effective leaders ask the right questions as they navigate uncertainty, evaluate risk, uncover unexpected opportunities, and build cultures that encourage curiosity and cross-functional thinking. We also examine how AI is reshaping executive decision-making and what today's biotech CEOs must do to balance innovation, growth, and long-term strategic vision.
Craig, in past conversations together, we've talked off and on about the sort of differential sometimes of great CEOs and leaders of curiosity and asking the right questions. I guess they're related, but asking the right questions maybe is even more pointed. You can be curious, but you may not get to the right question. But to get inside the situation and really get to the point quickly is quite a really important factor of success, right? And so I know you do that a lot and you talk about it. So I thought that might be something we could at least focus on.
Yeah, happy to talk about it. I think, you know, for me, business is a little less linear than I would have thought before I started all the different business aspects we've been in. It's a bit more of a random walk, I find. And I'll just give you a couple examples. When we first went to ILEX Oncology, myself and the CEO was the number two. ILEX was really a CRO working on other pharmaceutical companies' programs in oncology in particular. And it was a cost-plus business model. So you would develop for them and then you charge 20% markup. So my first project there was to take that company and those great developers and turn it into a proprietary business. So the idea is you move from 20% margins to 90% plus margins, and then you develop your own drugs, if you will, and not everyone else. Pretty interesting process to take the mindset of somebody that's processing, if you will, somebody else's programs to somebody that has to think through the clinical ramifications of how to get to market, speed to market, be differentiated in your clinical design for yourself. We did that, and it was quite a heavy project, I'll be honest. And but it was very successful in the end, because then our two oncology projects ended up coming through at much higher margin. The interesting part of that that no one foresaw was that our cancer drug, Campath, alotuzumab, ended up working in multiple sclerosis. And that wasn't on anyone's chart. I mean, the company was called ILEX Oncology, right? So it has oncology in the name. And yet your very active oncology therapeutic works in shutting down multiple sclerosis and very effective in solid organ transplant. We had a choice here. We saw the clinical team that had thought about this at Cambridge, and we kicked off the study when we saw the data. It was very controversial because no one was using a monoclonal antibody at that point for things like MS and T-cell diseases. They were really using it for oncology for the most part. Now, many people are using monoclonals for all kinds of things. But at the time, it was very, very unique. And clinicians had a hard time as we first approached them because there were products available from Pfizer and other companies. And when we said we want you to use this experimental drug, it was a big leap for them. In the end, Genzyme ended up buying ILEX Oncology due in part to this MS and solid organ transplant utilization. And in the end, took it off the market for oncology, and it's still available today. I think it's called Lemtrada, and ended up being part of a CVR when Sanofi was buying Genzyme. They really wanted to hold on to the value through a contingent value right. So fascinating to me to see that none of that would have happened had we not turned a company doing everyone else's drug development, but started doing its own. And then after that, to look and find that these products could be used in an entirely different way. And it was a combination of those two that led Genzyme to acquire ILEX. So you can see the random walk in there and how you have to be open to how your projects can be used in order to find value.
And I was impressed by that story, Craig, because a different way of looking at it is that ability to ask the right question. In other words, you unless you ask, well, couldn't we do it differently, or why wouldn't this work in this other area, all those potential opportunities don't happen. And so it does take that kind of mindset, I think.
You don't really know. That's why I
Yep.
say it's a bit of a random walk. You have to, follow your nose a little bit.
Yeah, I was going to ask you because in biotech, with your vast experience there, leaders are always pre they're presented with a lot of enormous amounts of data, right? So, and like you're saying, and asking those questions, how do you distinguish between the right questions that generate kind of the right insight from maybe the noise or from the ones that just, generate just more information? How do you kind of target that, do you think?
Well, I will say on one side, I'm a very data-driven person. That's the finance and the University of Chicago person in me. I do listen to the data and look at the trends and what you think is likely to occur. But there's a whole nother side of me that really believes in the people aspect of business. And at Silence, we had some great people. At ILEX Oncology, we just had some great people, all of which are going to continue to do very well in their careers. And they have their own well-thought-out views on where the market is, where the potential is, and where you're likely to be successful. So I have to say, to the extent I can, I use both sides of the brain there, the data side and also the people side, to get to an answer that you think is going to be the best one. And look, it's drug development in many cases. So as you know, in pharmaceutical drug development, it's a higher risk business. So you really have to make your most informed judgment and hope it works.
I do think sometimes it is really an important capability to look at that big picture. And one example, I think you may know of him or maybe not, Calvin Roberts, who's a esteemed eye doctor, eye surgeon, and he's now running a vast project to create a implantable eye. And I asked Cal the reason why they chose to create an implantable eye versus a new, a mechanical eye, something that's fabricated. And he said, well, it's pretty simple because I asked the question, what would work? And the answer was that to create the retinal connection that you'd have in a human eye would be a monumental challenge technically to re replicate. It's not like just, creating a artificial joint would be simple by comparison, and it's sort of up there with creating an element of the brain, apparently, to recreate the retina and how it connects to the nervous system. But to create an implantable eye was actually feasible. But he started out by just asking that basic question, because everyone said, well, it must be feasible to create a transplantable thing. And the answer is no, you need to use the existing eye, harvested from a cadaver, because otherwise you'll get nowhere. And that's where they're heading. And I think they're going to get there within 3 years. But again, it was that simple question before he went much further with it that got him there. But one thing I was wondering in your mind, Craig, is, and I have my own thoughts about it, but I wonder what you think of whether the ability to ask the right questions is something that you can develop in people, or is it just something that they almost inherit generically or genetically?
It's definitely both, because I've seen in the culture working with some people early on that are more one side or the other. In other words, where they're more task-oriented type people or they're more creative in their thinking. And I've watched both develop over a period of years. Aratana's classic, because you start with one idea of what you could do, and then you actually see what happens, and then you evolve. ILEX was the same thing. If you look at those people, they were great developers, but they were doing it for everyone else. And then to change and do it for yourself was just such a mindset change. So you can take one side and grow that other side out as long as you have the openness and the, flexibility by the people you're working with. And I've been blessed. I know, Ken, you have. We've been blessed by people around us that are very smart, educated, go-getters. And as Fred Hazen calls it, fire in the belly, the people with fire in the belly. And it leads you to a lot of really interesting spots.
Can you sort of train that skill in a way, develop it with the with teams, and encourage that critical thinking? Can you kind of build that into culture, you think?
You can do that. Actually, I'm doing a little bit of that now because I mentioned I'm working on a couple projects and I do have a few people working with me on different ones. And as part of that, we're meeting on a regular basis and talking about the pros and cons, what we can do, what we shouldn't do. And really, it becomes every couple weeks a really interesting time to do the pro and con analysis of the opportunity. And I love that because again, you see them feeling comfortable asking the question. I like it when it's cross-functional. I love it when the R&D people ask a finance question, or the finance people are asking, what is the MOA? I love that. The chemistry, for example, how is it differentiating the chemistry and it comes from a finance person? So that to me is when you're really getting to a group that likes working together and getting creative.
Yeah, I think that I've been doing quite a bit of thinking and work on the areas of neuroscience and biology and behavioral science around things like adaptability and agility, which are really related to asking questions. The ability to think about things in a out of the box way or a different fashion, and sort of just a different way of saying asking questions in the right way. And it's fascinating because there are some things that you can help with behaviorally, so you can provide the right behaviors that you would like to see in people. Very important to model those behaviors because if you just say you're open to risk taking, but then you punish people every time they take a risk, which happens all the time, then you're going to get what you expected, which people who are happy to talk about taking risk but won't because they can see the consequences. So there's a lot of that, I think, of leadership around those things. But then there's, I think, a lot to be learned and understood about how people react to different situations, why people behave the way they do in groups. There's lots of evidence, for example, that in sort of the wrong conditions, if you like, people will adapt a crowd mentality and they will all essentially agree with what may sound actually like a very stupid idea to them individually, but they're not going to say that. They won't even feel that. They'll just be, when they're surrounded by people who are all saying yes, there's a very, very high likelihood that they're going to join the yes crowd, even though if you took them away separately, they'd say no. And so I think from a leader point of view, it's really important to understand those dynamics because, what you're talking about, Craig, of getting the people in the room to talk freely and share ideas, isn't easy. And especially if you have people who are, on a team being asked to do something, at a fast pace and to come up with the right answer quickly, the unintended consequence sometimes is they simply say absolutely to whatever the fastest answer is to what they're being asked to do. And again, I guess that's partly a leadership challenge of how to slow people down or how to kind of unravel that groupthink that can happen so easily. It's a really complicated story, but when you think of all the things that have gone wrong in biotech and in all kinds of industries, an awful lot of the time it's because of that kind of groupthinking and a failure to ask the obvious questions. I think that's where it requires really a kind of high EQ leader to recognize the things that can happen. You don't just ask, what does everyone think? That just doesn't lead you where you need to go.
You do have to have the open-mindedness and the flexibility, and that is not always a given. I mean, you can imagine that ILX oncology story I love so much because imagine if you've got an entire organization that's been doing cancer and cancer development for other really good companies. You have a CEO that came in as someone who ran oncology for Pharmacia, and you have the entire medical network, CMO, et cetera, all cancer-focused, right? The oncologists working with us. And now you're going to go and you're going to tell them that this drug that we have, our lead drug, we're actually going to use in MS. So how different is that from what they were expecting when they woke up, in the morning for the last 3 years? It just was a very different notion. But that they wrapped their arms around it and we got it developed and it turned into $1 billion plus acquisition by a great company like Genzyme is just telling that it is there. There are many other opportunities if you're willing to open up to it.
It's kind of difficult, right, in the environment today to for leaders to strike that balance, right, between being disciplined, right, with their risk management, but then the encouraging open thinking and all that stuff. Is there one or two solutions to that, pragmatically, or what do you think?
That's interesting. I mean, I don't know what you think, Craig. I think it, these things really do come from the top, right? So I think you need somebody who's got enough confidence as a leader to provide the balance. And at the same time, there's the whole AI factor now, which is another really profound, complicating element. So, on one hand, AI provides sometimes faster, better routes to understanding something, but you have people who use it in the wrong way, and so they're using AI to come up with, they ask the wrong question and they're getting the wrong answers from AI. That's happening all the time. Or people are feeling outflanked by AI, and so it creates these inhibitions among people to actually be creative thinkers. Someone's telling them that AI has got the answer. And so I think it's more than ever, it's interesting with the increased importance of this new technology, the sort of human factor becomes even more important, right? As to how to lead through AI and AI use, and how to deal with even the human fear of AI, because there's a sense in almost every part of the industry you go into, including biopharma, that people at the entry level are no longer needed, and that creates all kinds of unintended consequences, including refusal to use AI, or an effort to undermine it, or to be battling with other people in the organization. It creates all kinds of huge issues that I don't think we've even begun to understand all the implications just from the human dynamics point of view of AI.
I think you're so right. It's such a huge change that it's bringing on. And I think to the extent you can adopt it early and partner with AI, you're just so much better off as opposed to being, living in fear of it. Because there are so many great applications. I mean, I think back to, some of the companies I worked with that had a genetic element to it. And you can imagine just by, anticipating the testing that you're going to have to do in clinical with data already generated as a head start by AI, whether it's the biobanks or, looking just at the genetic foundation of disease, it's just a fascinating way to partner with AI. But you're also right about those that just fear it. And I think you got to have a team that embraces it.
Yeah, and then the misuse of AI in different ways. None less than the Pope is out with an encyclical about the moral applications of AI. And I don't think his point of view is that AI should not be used. It's just more that there has to be that factoring in of the human element in this, and that you can't allow AI to make moral decisions, for example, which starts to arise in biotechnology and bioscience in many unexpected ways.
You're absolutely right, Ken. It's a whole new chapter, I think, that a lot of people are delving into. And again, if you can get them to embrace it early on, I think you're a lot better off.
And in a different way, thinking about, again, the ability to ask the right questions, as a leader, I think it's now become front and center in terms of choices that CEOs are needing to make about drug development and approvals, right? Because not to mention the origination of molecules, but just in the last half year or so, I think members of our network, the Vanguard network of CEOs, have started to talk quite forthrightly about making choices as to whether they're going to take their drug to the FDA or to another country for first approval or simultaneous approval, and similarly whether they'll take their drug for development into China especially. And that would have been, I think, Craig, probably unheard of 5 or 6 years ago. It was like, you'd be a marginal company and a marginal CEO if you discuss that kind of thing. And now some very, really very sharp and promising firms are doing that because of their, on one hand, their disenchantment with the FDA and the just regulatory chaos in the US, but also just because those other places have become so much stronger.
There's also the link to funding. You need to have kind of a funding source that is something you can count on. And so as these companies, I think, grow, they need to be able to go out and raise or IPO. Silicon Valley has been able to do that so well, and particularly now with all the AI things that they're working on. But you do see areas where science is occurring, but it's just not getting funded in the way. And for example, I think they're quite a few companies in London that I saw over a period of time where they're just underfunded. They're just not able to spend what they need in the clinical development. And so they get kind of underfunded, and that kind of crimps their growth. Whereas I think Boston has had a great biotech culture. And I have heard actually that Dallas is creating a much better funding culture. And Miami certainly is getting raised now as a place where you can go and take innovative ideas and get it funded, right? So I think a lot of that is occurring in tandem. And someone like Ken Griffin moving down to Miami, and all of his employees at Citadel, that's a funding mechanism that he's creating as well. So it's just another piece of that puzzle.
Yeah, actually, on speaking of funding, I mean, when you ask CEOs today what they care about, I mean, a few years ago they might have said, "Well, I'm worried about this molecule," or "I'm thinking about the right science person," or "Where am I going to find the right board lead?" But currently, the one thing on their mind is, "Are they going to? How do they get funded in this crazy environment?" And it was interesting. I don't know if either of you were at the Milken conference this year. I was not there, but I read a couple of accounts, and it was fascinating because there was a lot of temperature taking of what investors are looking for, and the sort of the word on the street had always been, well, right now they want nothing but products, product and product and product. They don't want any other factors. But according to a couple of reports I heard, there's now a bit of a pivot towards saying, well, actually what we're looking for in this crazy environment is CEOs and companies that have staying power and that are able to adapt to these changing circumstances, and also actually a certain amount of interest in platforms because they give you flexibility, whereas a product does not. It's, if something changes, the product doesn't. And so it was really interesting to just hear what, again, it's back to the questions these CEOs need to be asking is, what should we be doing, and how should we be positioning ourselves? It's not entirely like what you would thought. The assumption was that it's going to be for even more immediate, product answers to everything. And instead, it seems like there's an investor sentiment that's a bit different from that.
Yeah, there's certainly a de-risking when you've got a platform and you can choose, different areas to pursue. There's no question about that. People just have to get comfortable about the overall spend, the overall burn, and how long it's going to take. Because in pharma and biotech, as you know, it's a very different idea. It's quite a long lead time in order to get a product, thought through, get the IP, get it on the market. It's just a lot of time for all that development. And so you have to know what you're signing up for. And in many cases, it's, 5, 7 years, before you may see a payout if you're looking at an early idea. So, but they can be huge payouts. And so de-risking to the extent you can prioritize or shift or de-risk really helps that burn and get to answers so people feel success before they're putting money down on the next one.
I guess that goes back to the kind of the theme, right? Asking the right questions. Yeah, Craig, I was just curious. I mean, maybe to kind of wrap it in a bow a little bit. How was your approach to asking questions? How's that kind of evolved from, because you have the CFO finance leadership experience. How did that evolve as you transitioned to the CEO role? Your approach to asking those questions?
I frequently ask that question because it's almost a big a change for me professionally is moving from big pharma to smaller pharma, moving from CFO to CEO. CFO to me is one of the absolute toughest jobs, public company CFO, because you're so focused on risk and minimizing risk, and funding is part of that. As you move into the CEO role, you're really having to identify areas of growth. So it shifts from risk to growth. And I'm not saying that both roles don't think about both, because I've always had a great partner in a CFO and in a CEO. But really, that's what your board and your shareholders are looking to you for as a CEO, is what are your ideas for growth? And so it's a constant notion of looking across the field and trying to figure out, which crops are going to be the crops that are going to, return dividends back to your shareholders. And the CFO is a very, very heavy audit cycle, financing cycle, risk mitigation. So it is an element of different sides of that business. But they work very well together. If you get a team that works very well together, when you're pursuing growth, you want to know what your risks are. So you've got to have a good partner in the chair next to you.
I guess you approach the vision a little differently too, right? And the culture a little differently in those different roles.
Yeah, for me, it's you're looking out a little bit farther and trying to anticipate where areas of growth could be. And I think this technology play, the AI technology play, is really going to be a factor here. because it's going to give you ideas about all those opportunities that you didn't have 10 years ago.
Yeah, it seems to me, from what I'm seeing too, though, that the big challenge for CEOs is the question of where to place those bets. And AI is just two letters, but it's a huge ocean of different angles and approaches. And are you going to apply it to identify new molecules or even create them? Are you going to use it to identify ways to refine them? And are you going to be trying to use AI to generate many, many more molecules that are going to be all developed, sort of simultaneously through AI tools, or what? And where is that all going to lead you is some really tough choices. And that's the kind of those are the questions that no one really actually has an answer for. It's just a sort of a judgment call, isn't it? And somewhat experience based, but no one has a lot of experience with AI. So it's one of those moments, right, where we're suddenly faced with the invention of the wheel.
Yeah, even it continues going down the road. So even when you have developed an incredible drug, best in class, first in class, which fortunately I've been able to do, but even when you've done that, you look out in the future and where is the diagnosis for the use of that treatment going to be? AI is going to play a role in that, right? Highly likely. So some notion of shared responsibility with physicians, with insurance companies, you're going to get AI interfacing on the drug that you're actually bringing to market and impact its utilization. So it will continue.
Is there a risk of it sapping the curiosity that you guys were talking about with teams? I mean, that's, I guess, a whole other
That's a
discussion,
good
but
question.
yeah.
I don't personally, I don't think so. I think that with people who are AI savvy, I think they get more curious because it's easier to ask questions. But again, you need to, that's another great point about asking the right question. If you ask the wrong question of AI, you get the wrong, kind of answer. And so I think it really actually teaches people, or they develop a really much stronger capability to ask the right question. And for curious people, I think it increases their opportunity to build their curiosity. They go, oh, if that's the case, then what about this?
I've had that on a couple occasions where you get at the bottom, okay, I'm not really understanding what you're trying to get at, but how about this, right? It'll sometimes be at the bottom where have you thought about this? And actually, in some cases, I hadn't, and that leads me down another road of interrogation. So, look, to the extent I can do that and enhance creativity, we're all better off.